Hello, I'm Jeremy Rivero, your unscripted small business podcast host. I'm here today with Richard Gerhardt with Gerhardt Law. He's going to introduce his expertise, tell us what he paid so much money for to learn, and how it applies to you.
So we're just going to go with that. I'm the founder of Gerhardt Law. We're an intellectual property law firm specializing in patents, trademarks, copyrights, and trade secrets. And so patents protect technologies, trademarks protect brands, copyrights protect original work of expression like movies, novels, etc. And trade secrets protect secrets that give you a competitive advantage. And so we're a law firm that specializes in protecting our clients' ideas through all of those different tools. And so we've been in business for 20 years. We just celebrated our 20th anniversary. We have about 25 contributors. And it's just been an amazing journey. This month will be close to hitting our 5,000th client. So that's a lot of intellectual property over the years. And so what else do you want to know?
Well, I have actually some specific questions about podcasting and what is the interaction between this particular medium as it goes out and people who might reuse the content, people who are listening to it in general. I was trying to look this up myself, so it just happens to be fortuitous. I kind of want to understand in this venue, like with AI, LLMs, and, you know, consumability, like ingesting material, what are the third rails? When it comes to content, when it comes to, I think podcasting is considered a broadcast medium, but I might be wrong. How does that impact how businesses should think of the content they're putting out online to show up in these various surfaces?
Well, those are all great questions, and you've opened up a real can of worms there, Jeremy. So thank you very much. Let's start first with the AI stuff, because that is something that everybody is talking about. And the area of podcasting is most likely to be governed by copyright law. So it kind of falls into the same category as a book or a movie. It's content generated by a creator. And so once you create the podcast, you automatically get copyright protection on it. You can always file a copyright registration for the audio with the U.S. Library of Congress, but you don't have to. You automatically get copyright protection just because you made it, which is great. It's like the best deal in intellectual property law ever, right? So You've got that going for you. Now, if you throw in AI, that creates a bit of a conundrum. So, according to the law, artificial intelligence cannot be an author, right? So, if you're using, like for example, if you're using a voice mimicker. Like if you were to have a podcast with your clone, or if you were to have a podcast with another person, I think like Google Notebook, for example, can create podcasts that sound like a real podcast, but it's really just an AI voice. That material would not be copyrightable because there is no author other than the AI. And so you can't, it has to be a human being in order to be an author. Now, if it's a mixed situation where you have a human being and AI together, then the parts of the podcast generated by AI would not be copyrightable, but the parts generated by the human would be copyrightable. So it's sort of a gray area. I mean, so like, for example, what if you use a script that is generated by AI, or you use questions that are generated by AI. You ask those questions. Well, the spoken part would be protectable by AI, but would the transcript be protected by AI or by copyright? You know, that, you know, nobody really knows, right? Because the transcript really, if it was 100% generated by AI, then it may not be protected. Now, if the human being gives the AI in prompting, you know, substantial direction about what it is we're going to be talking about and fine points to bring up, then there could be some copyrightable material because the human interacted with it and used it as a tool. But as you can imagine, in these kinds of situations, there's a lot of gray areas, right?
Yeah.
And so where all of this kind of gets decided is in a courtroom. And so if there were a case, maybe around facts like I just stated, maybe AI generated a transcript and a human being read it, and then somebody copied it. I mean, imagine that. That's like a really weird turn of events. Then a court would hear the case. Each side would put on their own expert. One expert would say, oh, no, this is mostly driven by human creativity. And then the other side, defending, would say, the other side might say, no, it's mostly AI. And then a judge and a jury listen to it, and they make some sort of decision based on who knows what, right? So for each particular circumstance, it's always a little bit different. So, that's how these things work out. And in the age of AI, it can be kind of challenging sometimes to draw these lines because there's overlap and it's messy. And, you know, there isn't always, a really clear path forward. And then it depends too on where the content's being posted. So if you're putting it on a social media platform, mm-hmm. and once it goes on a social media platform, anybody can use it for anything if it's on that social media platform. Because when you post content on Facebook or YouTube, the rules specifically give anybody the right to use that content pretty much how they want, as long as it's not misleading or scandalous or something. And they can share it and say whatever they want about it. But if they take that content and post it on their website and it's no longer on the social media platform, then that could be a copyright violation, right? So it's very nuanced and it depends on what's going on where.
I love overly complicated situations like that because there's so many layers to it. And in having a little bit of expertise, I want to tease apart a couple of extra pieces out there because, you know, what you're throwing down seems, you know, on a surface pretty easy. But does YouTube count as a social media platform, or is that a video hosting platform that retains your signature, your ownership, as well as, you know, when I distribute this podcast, it doesn't just go, I've got distribution and it goes out to Spotify, it goes to Amazon Music, and then Deezer, and I've got signed up to RSS feed directories where it duplicates and sends out multiple copies to these different platforms. Necessarily, most of them go out with a raw transcript. And I have the opposite hope of on copyright of I hope somebody listens to it and takes a piece of it and puts it out there and then gives me an attribution. You know, I hope that they'll listen to it and mention, oh, hey, I was listening to the Unscripted Small Business podcast. And hopefully they'll link to the site, but maybe not, because nowadays with ChatGPT and LLMs, they'll give me citation attribution, but not necessarily a link attribution on where that might occur. But for me, that's beneficial to get into in front of people. So, what's your take on, you know, platforms like YouTube, And when either video content, because this is going to be both audio, video, and a transcript that goes out on these platforms, what's your take on that that conundrum?
Well, again, it's you're getting into a complexity in general. Recirculating content from YouTube is, I would consider that a social media platform, because, you know, the companies want you to, you know, want to share. And so you would have rights to share on streaming platforms for podcasting. I think that could be a little bit different, because there isn't quite the motivation to share. But to be honest, I don't have a good answer to that. So I really don't want to mislead your listeners with respect to copyright and on podcasting platforms like Castos or Spotify or Apple. I haven't been asked that question before. And so I would want to give a good answer. But once you go outside the platform, attribution is, you know, technically not enough. And so if somebody, you know, of course, the rights always vest with the copyright holder. So you can decide not to do anything about it if you're satisfied with the copyright usage. If somebody is using your content and you're happy about it, if they take it, say, from if you have your podcast listed on a website, and they take it from that website and they put it in a link to a Facebook page and they share it on Facebook, you may have rights against them, but you may decide not to exercise them. But, you know, for example, it comes up in, sports context all the time. You know, maybe there's a picture, a copyrighted picture of LeBron James, right? And so LeBron puts it on his website, and then a fan innocently copies that and circulates it on Facebook, and say, oh, this came from LeBron James' website. Well, it depends a lot on LeBron's attitude toward these kinds of things. On the one hand, he may want to protect his commercial image because it's worth money to him, right? And so he may not want people just spreading it around and using it for their own gain. If somebody made, you know, LeBron t-shirts and they copied a photograph from his website and they put it on a t-shirt, they're commercially exploiting his celebrity. And so a lot of celebrities don't like that. Mm-hmm. And even if he said, oh, I took this from LeBron's website, you know, that's not going to save it if LeBron decides to chase after him. There was a pretty famous case with Oprah Winfrey. There was a podcast, the Oprah Winfrey Fan Club, and all they would do is say nice things about Oprah, but she decided that she didn't want other people, you know, using her name. And so she asked them to, you know, change the name of their podcast and stop making references to it. And because the challenge is, especially with famous people, if one person does it, a lot of other people might want to do it too. And they may not be, and it dilutes the brand. So, you know, I don't know. I hope that answers your question a little bit.
No, it does. I'm curious, because one of the first contexts where I really ran up against copyright law, I worked for a real estate hosting company, and realtors would ask, oh, hey, here's a picture, put it up on the site, you know, and we got a demand letter from Getty, from the lawyers at Getty, and they said, you have copyright images that violate copyright, and you've damaged us, and you're going to pay us $500 or we'll take you to court. And I found out that actually Getty Images has a entire legal practice attached to them, whose entire business model is just shaking down small business owners and threatening them to try to get them to settle these violations. Were you aware of that? And what's your take?
Well, I am aware of that. We actually represent some photographers in that space. We also represent people who received the cease and desist letters, and I can see it on, both sides of the coin. Some photographers make more money doing that than they do selling their work. I mean, it's really pretty fascinating. I would say, I can see both sides of it. That part of the motivation for registering a copyright is that when you register a copyright, the law entitles you to statutory damages. And so one of the things about copyright infringement is that sometimes damages are hard to prove. And so if you were just to file a lawsuit and the copyright wasn't registered, if that were even possible, it's not, but then you would have to prove in court, well, how was, in this case, Getty Image, damaged. And so there's a provision in the copyright law that if the work is registered, then they can get statutory damages, which pretty much means if you can prove infringement, the damages are automatic and you don't have to prove the damages.
Hmm.
And that makes lawsuits much more attractive to copyright holders because if it's the same picture, it's obvious. And then the infringement's obvious. And then the only question is, well, what are the damages? And the law provides $500 to $20,000 per occurrence of infringement. And so the economics for the photographer kind of work out. And a lot of photographers will pursue them these things themselves. Sometimes they'll have attorneys help them, but in a way, the photographer has to support themselves, right? And they have to. And if somebody else is borrowing an image, then in theory, that they should get compensated for that, right? Because it's most photographers spend a lot of time learning their craft and you have to take a lot of pictures before you get a good one. And then you have to know how to adjust the color and frame it and all this other stuff. So it's not just like snapping photographs and posting them on Instagram, right? It's a trade. And so from their perspective, it's perfectly justified. Mm-hmm. It's like you're taking my creative work and you're using it to make money and I'm not getting any benefit from. On the other hand, if you're on the receiving end of one of these things, you're kind of like, well, I didn't know. I mean, it's just the photograph on the internet. What's the big deal? Right. And so you're kind of like, what? You want $15,000 because I used one photograph once? Right. And it comes across as just like, sometimes there's overreaching there, right? In terms of what is the real damage there?
Yeah.
And and most people like don't really think about copyright law when they're wandering around. So it's tempting, right? Just to take a photograph and reuse it. And like you're saying, even if you're giving them an attribution, even when sometimes they do, then you feel like you're helping the person because you're spreading the word about their photograph. So, I mean, what is morally right? I think, both sides have, legitimate arguments. I mean, I will say, for example, like some of the lawsuits around AI, Anthropic, was involved in a lawsuit where they went to a pirated website in the Caribbean and they downloaded millions and millions of books or uploaded the content in all those books to train their LLMs. And none of the people who wrote those books got paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you're thinking about, you know, I mean, it's tough to make a living as a creator, right? You know, you're not usually rolling in dough unless you're one of the lucky ones, but you spent a lot of time working on this book, and maybe it's a text on cardiovascular health.
Yeah.
You're written by a doctor for other doctors, and it took years of research and pulling it all together, and then it gets swallowed up in the LLM. And it gets used, and you don't get anything out of it. You don't get at least if you sell a book, you get some payment.
So the AI loophole that you mentioned for does then exist in some form of if you saw a picture, you gave it to Midjourney, and it gave you your own, because it's not copyrightable, it spat out a version of it that's not the original. It's kind of different. Is that fair use? And is that the better practice now? Because you also do have, you know, I do got to give a shout out to, let's see, Death by Stock Photos, Pexels, and a handful of others where they do, CC0, or free attribution, free with use with attribution, free use. But, you know, if you like an image and you take it over to Midjourney, and you get a Midjourney version of it, is that a fig leaf, or is that a fig leaf that'll protect you from that Getty Images email?
So, first of all, it depends on how closely the original work, how closely the new work resembles the original work, and so. You know, Midjourney probably, they wouldn't have copyright rights in it, and you would not have copyright rights in it.
Right.
From an ownership standpoint.
Yeah.
But that's different from the enforcement standpoint, where, you know, if you weren't the one who took the photograph, if you're using somebody else's photograph and you're creating what's known as a derivative work from it using AI, it may be infringed. You may be in trouble. You may not. It depends on how much of the photograph you change. And you go back to the courtroom and you put the old photograph up and the new photograph up and you ask people, is there a substantial similarity between the photographs? And the judge and the jury look at it and they say yes or they say no, you know, and it just maybe depends on the tie that the lawyer is wearing that day, or, you know, who knows? They all want to get out of there and go to the ball game, right? So, you know, I mean, if I didn't trust that guy, you know, and so, you know, they make a decision, and that's, and we live with that. That's how we decide some of these things. And it's not so clear cut that there's like, you know, it's so straightforward. So, what? I mean, AI has definitely murked up the waters for copyright, and you know, it's a blessing and it's a curse. And if you're a victim of, I mean, I know artists who are furious because AI is taking work that it took them 30 years to learn a technique. To learn there, and then AI just takes in, you know, and it's, you know, it's close enough that nobody's going to pay them what they were charging it, you know, for it, right? On the other hand, if you're working on a brochure and you need some cool artwork, boom, 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 you have your image in 30 seconds and you didn't have to pay anybody. Maybe you paid ChatGPT. But, you know, you have it right there and it's good and you can use it. You don't have to, you know, mess around with all of this stuff. So it just depends on what side where you're sitting when it happens, I suppose.
let's take the concept of those trade secrets you were talking about, because you talked about, there's patents and trade secrets. So, I work with, an industrial manufacturer. I think they make oxygen monitors. What are best practices for a business to try to protect their secret sauce in the day and age of where you don't have to, pay developers for, specialists? Somebody can be throwing stuff into AI and trying to come up with stuff, and they end up making a facsimile or a copy of what ends up to be your trade secret. Like, how defensible is your trade secret if somebody's, throwing stuff into the black curtain behind, the black box that's AI, and like, I think this, and this. Guess for me what the secret ingredient is in Coke. And they find out, they try it and that actually turned out to be it. Is that secret still defensible in court if they just asked AI and it happened to get the right answer? Or is there inherently a level of protections behind the concept of patents and trade secrets that manufacturers should know about?
Oh, that's a really interesting question, and one I haven't really thought about before when it comes to trade secrets. But in general, if something is reverse engineerable to the public, then it's not really a trade secret anymore. Because by definition, a trade secret is a secret that gives you a commercial advantage, right? And so, for example, traditional trade secrets are things like maybe a customer list. And so an employee leaves the company and they take a customer list with them. Well, that, if the company had taken the proper steps to, protect the confidentiality of that, it could be considered a trade secret. And then they could have an action against the departing employee. Things like manufacturing processes and recipes, how long to cook this and what are the ingredients here? Those are, that old secret family recipe. Those things are the traditional, trade secrets. So, to the extent that you could use artificial intelligence to reverse engineer, just based on publicly available information, and you could use it to reverse engineer a trade secret, then that weakens the trade secret protection substantially, even if the owners did everything they were supposed to do. And I think, for example, trade secrets and software used to come up, pretty regularly. You would have a back end, which is where all the programming happens, the databases, server links, and then it would present to a customer on a website. Maybe the customer would drag and drop some drawings in, or something else, and then the website would turn out a particular type of drawing, maybe, or something like that, using technology that the customer never saw. And a lot of companies relied on trade secret protection because they didn't think that the interface would provide enough information for the customer or client to understand how the output was generated. And with AI, though, if AI could come up with a way to replicate what the customer is getting without actually doing the programming, then that would weaken the trade secret protection of the software company. So again, it depends on how the particular situation. But I mean, I think, you know, I don't know. You know, there's AI still has a lot of problems, a lot of hallucinations where, you know, it thinks it solved the problem, but it hasn't yet. Right.
That AI sloth is 100% a problem, not just in the content creation, but it's also AI sloth when it comes to coding, you know, when it comes to developers. You know, I think there was a famous example like 2 weeks ago where the password was written in the clear just because they used AI to come up with it. And AI didn't think it was a problem that the code that would allow somebody to download everybody's contact information, it didn't occur to it that that needed to be protected, you know? So AI slop is everywhere. But that does, that poses another challenge to patents. If you're developing software and developing workflows and processes in combination with Claude Code or ChatGPT, does that functionality of having used AI in the process of building this software suite mean that it cannot be patent protected? Just as when you're writing content and publishing it on the internet, and if the AI voice is speaking it, it can't be copyrighted? Does that apply to code as much as it does to a public document or a performance of a fake AI voice of the same script?
That's a great question, Jeremy. And your analogy is sound. The patent laws require a human inventor. So case law was settled several years ago where you couldn't file a patent on technology that was wholly created by AI. And in that case, the inventor specifically did not name himself as an inventor, but only his AI system. And the court said, no, you can't have it. AI cannot be an inventor on a patent. So it's a tricky area. And, on several levels. So the first and most obvious one is you can use AI like a tool. So the patent office guidelines specifically allow you to use AI as a tool, just like you would use any, like if you were in a lab and you distilled something, it's no different from distilling a compound than it is using AI, you know, to draft code. The complexity comes in when AI starts adding ideas to the invention that the inventor never contemplated.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one of the things AI does is it says, well, did you ever think of this? and if you say, oh, that's a good idea, I think I'm going to put it in my patent, then in theory, that claim, that part of the patent would not be enforceable, right? And so yes, you can use AI to write your code. But you can even put AI concepts in your patent. You just have to be careful that when you file the patent, you write it in a way so that the scope is really limited to what humans actually contributed to or control, right? So that's pretty much the way it is with patents, and it's challenging. I mean, we have inventors that will have AI write the patents for them, and they'll bring them in, and they're almost always wrong. You know, and it's very hard to convince some people because it's like, well, it looks like a patent. It's fine. No, usually it's not. I mean, I do think within, you know, a couple of years, soonest, I do think that AI will be able to draft, you know, good quality patents, but it hasn't learned enough on how to do that yet. And, so, And so people you have to appreciate that when you put your ideas into an LLM, if it's a public LLM, and then you're technically disclosing your invention.
Yes.
And so, so that also has consequences. And people don't appreciate that. Now, if you're going to, you know, put your ideas, into, the LLMs, then you need to make sure that the LLM has safeguards. One of the cases we did a blog post on not too recently was, a guy who was accused of a white collar crime, and he went to a public LLM and started putting in all sorts of information about his case. And the LLM gave him answers, and he went through and he did all that. And then later the lawyers said, well, we want to see that. You know, on the other side, they said, you know, that's all discoverable. And the court said, yep, the opposing side has every right to look at that. It wasn't done under, privilege by attorney. So it's not privileged. And, you know, they looked at the privacy policy of the LLM.
Yeah.
It basically, you know, it had holes in it large enough to drive a truck through. Right. So he had to turn over all of this stuff, and some of it was incriminating. You know, you could say, well, what if I, you know, I, so suppose I did this, and, you know, and so it's going to take us a while to learn how to use these things, properly. But if you're in a legal situation, you need to be very, very careful. And, you know, if there's ever a chance that it could turn out to be a problem for you. So. Word to the wise.
It's fascinating because there's a lot of the expected infrastructure and architecture of like the corporate and business world, you know, just has like kind of these fuzzy walls of the sudden occurrence of AI being injected everywhere. You know, I know discoverability of emails and court cases has been gone to different litigation levels, whether or not police can force you to use your own fingerprint to open a device for them that's under investigation. But then if you are walking around and just plugging in, you know, parts of your crimes into just, you know, vanilla LLMs, yeah, discoverability, that's a pretty big loophole. But it also could apply to, you know, some of your, you know, corporate and trade secrets. Like, have you taken the extra steps to, you know, get a open source or a locally hosted version of an LLM tool to process? I've worked with a couple of SaaS tools, and they converge on, you know, some of these medical industry devices. And so HIPAA does, how, if you have an interface within your medical portal, you know, what happens if somebody puts a, what would otherwise be a HIPAA protected query into your LLM chatbot system? Is that discoverable? Like, how much protections do you have to worry about on the back end of that?
Yeah. So yes, the LLMs are generating a lot of new work for lawyers. That's true. But I really want our clients to, you know, to do the right things and to avoid, you know, the obvious pitfalls, right? And, average person is not going to think about this stuff all that much.
Yeah.
And they shouldn't. You shouldn't be walking around thinking about intellectual property law unless you love it. It's better to find somebody that you can trust and get your questions answered. But it's also very new. It's new to the attorneys, and it's, you know, it's new to the world, and it's just going to take some time to work through some of these issues. But the challenge is that, you know, what can you do safely? What can you do without, you know, taking big risks? There was another case that was recently decided for expert testimony in lawsuits. So lots of times, if you have like some sort of Superfund issue, then part of the court record usually includes an opinion from an expert who is, you know, spent a long time studying Superfunds, and they render opinions. There's lots of different types of experts that appear in courts. And the general rule is whatever an expert does can, and whatever information the expert relies on should be part of the court record if the attorneys ask for it during discovery. And there was a recent case where an expert wrote an opinion and used LLMs almost exclusively for it. And, you know, the expert's supposed to be neutral, relatively neutral, right? That gives them credibility.
Yeah.
And this guy was just like, well, how can I write this expert report so I win for my client, right? And all of that stuff got turned over to the other side, and they just killed the case for him right then and there.
Wow.
So, and, you know, the expert wasn't thinking, you know, but unfortunate. So it does have consequences, right? And hopefully there's a wake up call there for people who won't need a confession when it comes to stuff like that.
I have a slightly different tack, because in my industry, search engine optimization, patents do play a role, but kind of an opposite role, because we're actually using patents as disclosed technology that somewhere within Google, there's a PageRank algorithm and they patented it, and they had to describe to a certain degree the functionality of that patent. Now, whether that patent is still operable in whole or in part or part of a larger system, you know, that's for us to second guess and argue and bicker within ourselves. But I'm curious if you have any context for looking from the outside in for our industry and niche. What should we know about how companies think about patents for software processes that they're wanting to protect? And, you know, what are some of the ways that somebody looking in from the outside might get some things turned around?
Well, there's a couple of different angles to that. The first is that the larger picture is that patents were actually put in Article 2 of the Constitution as a fundamental part of our founding, because it was believed that if you granted somebody a monopoly and exclusivity on technology, then the cost of that is that you have to share it, right? So from the outset, patents were considered important to the innovation engine, because people could learn from them, and then after they learned from them, they could build on that technology and develop new technologies, right? So that's an important part of the public service that the patents serve, and it's that sharing function is very fundamental. The concern always was that if everybody keeps everything secret, then we don't learn from each other as well. And that's what the patents are designed, you know, to do. It used to be that that a company had to put the best mode of practicing the invention into the patent. You didn't have to label it as the best mode, but the best mode was the best way that in the inventor's subjective opinion that how to make and use the invention. So best mode and that was part of the duty of disclosure. And your patent could be unenforceable if you didn't put that information in there. It's changed over the years. It's still in some of the patent regulations, but you won't see it as a subject of litigation. In a lot of ways, the American system on that piece is sort of tracking the rest of the world, because the rest of the world didn't require the best mode. And so American companies felt like they were being penalized for having to put in this information. But you still have to meet the enablement requirement. And the enablement requirement means that you have to disclose enough information to allow one skilled in the art to make and use the invention. So in the case of a software patent, some of it you can read and you could say, well, a normal software engineer would know how to do this. But you have to put in the patent enough information so that this normal software engineer could do it without, too much experimentation. So there are legal duties to, disclose. Now, a lot of companies try to kind of hide all of the gems and the patents. That's part of the game, because they don't want their competitors to review it. And then, the government wants everybody to get it, but the companies don't want anybody to get it. They just want the patent, right?
Yeah.
So, in general, you should expect that the information that's put into the patents is accurate to the best of the knowledge of the inventors. Because a patent, if people are just making stuff up, then the patent's not enforceable. And so their attorney should be telling them, let's just play it straight here. We want this patent to be worth something. If you're just making stuff up or you're being too misleading, it's not going to stand up in court. And if that's the case, why even do it, right? If you're worried about disclosure. So I don't know if that answered your question.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's helpful. Final two questions kind of turn the mirror back around you. It is the Unscripted Small Business Podcast. So I'm curious, do you use AI within your own business? There was a study by Ignavito of they checked 1,824 businesses and 68% of them never responded to somebody reaching out to them within 24 hours. Do you use AI to help on your marketing side, manage responses, have an AI chatbot on your site? Like, what's your leverage look like with these AI and LLM tools within your own organization?
Well, we have a company that we work with that specializes in, creating AI systems for us. We're very careful to make sure that we maintain confidential information of our clients. So there isn't any AI system except for Microsoft Copilot that has exposure to our clients' information. We've been assured by Microsoft that Copilot is within its own tenant and the data protections are very good. And it's, from my understanding, it's approved by the Bar Association for those types of uses. But there's other stuff that we do, right now we're automating cover letters. So when we have a piece of correspondence that comes in from the patent office, we have a system that analyzes that response and then creates a reporting letter for the client that calls out the deadlines, summarizes the response, tells them what needs to be done, and then it's reviewed by an attorney And then, you know, after that, it gets sent to the client. So we're using it for things like that. I personally don't use AI to write emails because I like people hearing me.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty, you know, but I might once in a while ask an LLM for an opinion on something that I'm going to write. But I don't want to lose my voice. I think that we still need to have, if everything sounds like AI, then, you know, I don't want to live in that world yet. And so, we use it, you know, all the time. We use it to manage engagement letters. We use it on proper platforms like Lexis. We use it for legal research. But all the time we're very conscious of confidentiality. And it's still not a substitute for legal experience or legal judgment. A lot of things have to be corrected. And, you know, I think that's where I think AI can take some of the burden off of routine tasks. But for the higher level stuff, you still need a person. So
give a final shout out. Let people know how they can connect with you.
Anybody is interested in intellectual property more, or if you have an issue, we're always happy to discuss that. Contact us at Gerhardt Lodge, ARHART. I just wanted to say thank you, Jeremy. It's been a real pleasure to be on, and I appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts.
I appreciate you coming on. If anybody wants the copy of the transcript, there'll be a version I'll be handing over to Richard for his site. And an abbreviated version of it will be made available on unscriptedsmallbusiness.com. Thanks for stopping by.